Hey everyone, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's great to give the seminar here. So yeah, I will talk about getting cosmological and astrophysical constraints, especially using small scales. And I'll be using the data from Dark Energy Survey, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and Planck. So naturally, the work has been done with both DS and ACT collaboration, but especially with the help of people listed here. Okay, so getting the cosmological constraints from small-scale correlations between different tracers of the background matter field is generally hard. It's kind of hard because of impact of very complex and poorly understood astrophysics, or especially gastrophysics, on the large-scale structure. So one of the issues is that we don't directly get to observe the underlying matter field, but we only get to observe the tracers of the matter field. And some of the tracers, for example, the galaxies, are a biased tracer, meaning that if in this particular plot you consider the fluctuations as the fluctuations in the overdensity of underlying matter field, the galaxies will only form in these special locations. And this leads to the biasing of the density of these tracers versus the density of the underlying matter field. And this is encoded as galaxy biasing. And as you look to smaller and smaller scale, this biasing gets highly nonlinear. Moreover, even if you had the underlying matter density field, it's difficult to get cosmological constraints from those because very high energy phenomena happening inside galaxies, for example, exploding supernovae or gas accretion from the active galactic nuclei, even though they happen in galactic scales or subgalactic scale, they are so energetic that they change the matter distribution out to megaparsec scales. So understanding both of these phenomena constitute the largest systematic uncertainty, even with current data. And as we lead to stage 4 survey data, it will be of paramount importance. And not only that, like understanding these phenomena has implications for understanding galaxy formation, the nonlinear dynamics of how galaxies merge, etc., how CGM and IGM physics behave. Okay. So to give a little more motivations, the plot that you're seeing was the sub part of the data that was used back in 2017 by Dark Energy Survey to infer the cosmological constraints. So what this data vector is, I'll briefly describe later also, but the main point to take away is that the total significance of this detected data was around 120 sigma, which is all the black points that you see with the error bars. But we only used 42 sigma worth of signal to noise to infer the cosmology. That is only the points that lie in the white region. All the points in the gray shaded regions were thrown away. So we threw away more than half of our data points. And the main reason was because we did not understand how complicated the galaxy biasing is in these small scales, and also how baryonic physics impacts these small scales. So I've spent my PhD thesis in trying to understand both of these phenomena and trying to address both of these. So the galaxy biasing, which probes the nonlinear galaxy matter connection, and the baryonic feedback, which probes how the violent processes happening inside galaxies impact the large scale structure. So I'll briefly talk about both of these in this talk. Okay, so let's start with galaxy biasing. So our goal is to try to push our analysis to smaller scales of analyzing the correlations between tracers of large scale structure by modeling the more nonlinear galaxy biasing. But we want to do that with minimal number of free parameters so that we can maximize the gain in cosmological constraints. And in here, we will aim to describe the projective statistics. So we will not model the impacts of, for example, the redshift space distortions. So to model these small scale correlations, there are primarily two ways. There is one halo model based approach, which posits that all the matter lives in small viralized halos, and the galaxies populate those viralized halos. So although this is a very physically motivated picture, it is generally hard to get right in the inter-halo to intra-halo regime, as well as the form of so if you try to write down the actual cross correlation between different tracers, it's very dependent on the kind of tracer that you are looking into. So what kind of galaxy it is it galaxy or is it, for example, the H1 or something like that. Another more physically motivated way is the perturbation theory based approach, which gives you a tracer independent controlled expansion. So this does not have as large of a regime validity as the Halo model. So it's only valid in relatively larger scales. But the form of the expansion that you can write of how the overdensity of any tracer depends on the overdensity of the underlying total matter field is very controlled. So you can, as you sequentially push to smaller and smaller scales, you can expand into the lowest order, the next higher order, and the significantly higher order as you go in smaller scales. Okay, so directly modeling the overdensity field and trying to get the cosmology from just the overdensity field, for example, delta G, for example, if you try to look at overdensity of galaxies, it's kind of hard. So we again use the principles of homogeneity and isotropy and try to simplify our analysis by analyzing the two-point statistics. So for example, if you try to look at two-point statistics of the galaxy overdensity or galaxy matter overdensity, in this way, you don't have to worry about exactly modeling the delta G to full scales. So if you model these two-point correlations, for example, the galaxy matter correlation in the Fourier space, you can write down this particular power spectra and split it neatly into three different parts. So if we were doing a very simple analysis focusing on very large scales, we can just write down the galaxy matter power spectra as directly proportional to the power spectra of the total underlying matter field. And all the properties about galaxies are encoded in the single number B1. But if we try to push to smaller scales, we get two extra terms. So this is one loop perturbation theory term, and you get three additional free parameters. And this particular terms capture the effects of gravitational non-locality, that anything that's happening here will be gravitationally impacted by things that are happening a little bit further away. But then due to the effects of feedback, et cetera, things can move also. So there is also a spatial non-locality that the gas that will in the end collapse and form a galaxy can be coming from someplace else other than what is dictated by the gravitational physics. And this is encoded in these two terms. So this is the higher derivative plus effective field theory formalism. So this 5-6 parameter model is complete up to third order and is completely tracer independent. All the properties about tracers are encoded just in these 5-6 parameters, while the kernels that you see here are directly theoretically calculable using linear and nonlinear matter power spectrum. So to model the first term, we use the numerical simulations, particularly the Halo fit approach. And for the other kernels that you see, the other power spectra, we calculate as a convolutional integral using the linear matter power spectrum. So after using this, we don't need the sound speed square term, and we end up with five parameters that we have to see how many can we actually fix, and do we need all five parameters to describe the statistics up to the precision that we care about. So in the end, we will.
Shivam, can I ask? So you said that you can drop the CS square term. Like, why again was that? I didn't quite follow.
So the CS squared term is the effective field theory term for the matter distribution, and because we are modeling the P matter at full nonlinear level using numerical simulation, so this is already including all the nonlinear effective field theory effects that can impact the matter distribution.
So yeah, but you're looking at galaxies, not at the matter field, right? And for galaxies, I see. Okay, like yeah, so, you already have so a this B. Term remains,
So this term remains. We try to see if we can fix that to zero or not. So this thing is not completely separable, because if you also write down PGG, the numerical coefficients that you get are different, so you cannot club both of these together as a single term if you are jointly modeling PGG and PGM. So that's why I've written it separately. But we do have a K-square term in the final.
Okay, great. So one more question. So are you working entirely in real space, not in retro space?
We are working entirely in real space because we want to model the projected statistics. In the end, when we apply to data, we for the linear term, we also include just for the first term, we include the impact of Kaiser RST on our projected statistics. But we don't model it at the higher loop level. And because it's projected statistics, we are not as sensitive to RST effects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Yeah. Thanks. So this is the expression that's written in the Fourier space, but in the end, from our data side, we observe everything in the real configuration space. So we actually measure and model the configuration space analog, the correlation functions psi gg and psi gm. Okay, so as I mentioned, we have five free parameters and we want to test how many of them can we fix or remove. So we can actually, for two of the parameters, the BS and B3NL that came into previous expansion, we can actually motivate a theoretical relation between these two. So say we start with the initial mass density field and we want to model the final number density field. There are two approaches that you can take. You can actually evolve the matter density field to the current redshift and then come up with the biasing scheme for your tracer, which is known as Eulerian biasing scheme. Or you can do the biasing in the Lagrangian space or at very high redshift and then evolve it, do the nonlinear evolution. And as long as you are consistent and at what order you are modeling everything, both of these should be equivalent. And if you do that, you find that BS and B3NL are related to the linear bias parameter. And also, if you assume that everything is spatially local, you can also set this thing to zero. So we want to see if these relations hold. Do we need additional contribution of these parameter in the high redshift, and can we assume there is a spatial locality or not? Okay, so I'll first show the validation on very high resolution simulation, which are Cosmo DC2 simulation run for LSST-like survey. So this was the work that was led by then Penn undergrad Sam Goldstein. So this uses a 3 gigaparsecs box at a single redshift here, just at redshift of one, and has very high mass resolution. So what you see in this particular plot is the measured galaxy correlation function and galaxy matter correlation function. And the three, so those are the black points. And the three lines that you see is the best fit that we get if we assume a 5-parameter model, a 3-parameter model, and 2-parameter model. So the 5-parameter model frees all the 5 parameters with a very wide prior.
Sorry, can I ask you something? Are these HOD on top of a simulation, or is it just a galaxy formation simulation?
This is a HOD-based simulation. This was an N-body simulation that was then... I think like they also include effects of assembly bias, et cetera, but I think it is HOD based.
Right, but then, so you're assuming that the HOD itself is correct, and so that, I mean, there's no missing physics in HOD, because I mean, I wonder whether that could make a difference. Well, I suppose then that could give you different bias parameters, but I mean, the HOD is not the final of the story, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, like, we are not interested in modeling inter halo physics. So we will limit ourselves to model at maximum till 4 megaparsecs, and 4 megaparsecs are significantly larger than how you actually place galaxies in the halos. So in that sense, it should be less sensitive to that.
Thanks.
Sure.
And just to follow up on that, so you mentioned this 3E9 mass resolution. So is that the particle mass, or is that like the smallest resolved halo?
I think this is smallest resolved. Oh wait, no, this should be the particle mass. I think this should be particle mass.
Oh, okay.
That'll be very low.
And so then when you say then galaxies, what halo masses then are you populating with galaxies?
Wait, now that I think, yes, sorry, I'll get back to you on this, because now that I think more, I think this is the halo mass, but the galaxies are going down to, they are being populated down to all this minimum halo mass. Yeah, I think this is the halo mass.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just that because like the actual magnitude limit goes down to, I think, 26 or 27. So I think like we do need very low mass halos to populate those galaxies. So it should be the halo mass. Yeah, so I think like all the halos above this are used in populating the galaxies. Okay, yeah, so...
I just had a couple of quick related questions on the plot. One is that it looks like the three-parameter model fits worse than the two-parameter model.
It does look like it, but it's mostly because we have very tight error bars in this regime. So, like for example, what you're seeing is just the percent residual, but if I actually plot the chi-square of three-parameter model is better than two-parameter model, which is our goodness of fit criteria that we use when getting the best fit. So because three-parameter model fits in here very well, it's a little bit biased, like a couple of sigma biased here, yeah.
Oh, I see. And then I was also wondering why it doesn't look like in the three-parameter model, the bias approaches a constant on large scales.
I think like this is because I'm cutting the configuration space measurements to 40 megaparsecs, which we decided to do because we wanted to get covariance using jackknife procedures. So we needed small boxes to do it. But I think like in this particular paper, I should not say in prep, it's already in archive, but in this particular paper, we also do things in Fourier space where we actually use large scale modes. So in there, all the parameter like 5-3 or 2 parameter model like approach constant in large scales or small k values. And I think like same would be true if I had extended this thing to large R and somehow got in a reliable covariance matrix.
Great. Okay. That all makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot. In here, what you see is the fitted best fit curves for the 5-3 and 2 parameter model. And the plot in the bottom, what you're seeing is the residual. And the point I would like to emphasize is the y-axis only goes from -1% to 1%. So what you see is all of the three models can fit this particular measurements to better than 1% accuracy if you use all the points above 6 megaparsecs. But to quantify this thing a little bit more, in this particular plot, what you're seeing is the maximum percent deviation. So if you look at all the filled triangles of red, blue, and orange, what you're seeing is the maximum percent deviation in either PsiGG or PsiGM for 5-parameter model, 3-parameter model, or 2-parameter model. And even for 2-parameter model, you see that it is able to fit both PsiGG and PsiGM to better than 4% accuracy, even if we model down to 4 megaparsecs. So as long as we don't care about better than a percent accuracy, we can use 2-parameter model, but a 5-parameter model is able to fit both of them down to 0.1 or 0.2% accuracy. Okay, but as I mentioned, like this, all this validation was done at a single redshift snapshot. We cannot use just this validation to apply to direct data. So before we apply to dark energy survey measure data, we also need to do validation in across full redshift and also for galaxy selection and redshift that are of interest of dark energy survey. So in this particular plot, what you see, the top row is for galaxy. You're again seeing the residual, and the bottom row is for galaxy matter. And four columns are for four different redshift that's listed in the text. So if you just focus on the red points and the black points that show the residual of this two parameter model for two different galaxy samples that we in the end observe, or make analogous data using the observed dark energy survey catalogs. So the red points correspond to a red magic sample that consists of red galaxies and have small photometric redshift error estimate. And the black points correspond to this magnitude limited sample. So they don't select aggressively on color, and they only select on the I band magnitude, and it's a redshift dependent cut. So this has larger number of galaxies, but because we are not exclusively selecting on color and we don't have spectroscopic information, the photometric redshift estimate has more error compared to the Red Magic sample. But we use both of those samples in the data. But the point to take away is that across all redshift and for both of those samples, we can fit the galaxy and galaxy matter to better than 1% or 2% accuracy. Okay, so before we jump to application to the DSY3 data, we don't get to observe the galaxy and matter field both. Like we get the galaxy field, but we don't get the matter field directly. What we actually observe is the position and shape of the galaxies. So it's a photometric survey, and it takes very deep images of very faint galaxies. And using that, it extracts the position and the shape of the galaxies very well. And while position is a tracer of the underlying matter field, the shape is also a tracer of the underlying matter field, because if you take the light from any background galaxy and as it travels through the underlying matter field, it gets weakly gravitationally lensed. And this weakly gravitational lensing changes the observed shape. So if you correlate the observed shape, you're probing how the matter is clustering between you and the background source galaxies. So using these two tracers, the position of the galaxy and shape of the galaxy, you can construct three different two-point functions, which we call 3x2 points. So the shape correlation is the shear 2-point, the position of the foreground galaxies is galaxy clustering, and the correlation between shape of background source galaxy and position of foreground galaxy is galaxy lensing. So this galaxy clustering and galaxy lensing we call 2x2 point, and the correlation between the shape is 1x2 point. So this galaxy clustering is analogous to the psi GG that we saw earlier, and galaxy lensing is analogous to psi GM that we saw there. And these were the data vector that we saw way back in second slide when we saw which data was used to infer DS cosmology constraints. Okay, so going from actual taken data of the images to final cosmological parameters is a non-trivial process. So you have to take the data, you have to process it, characterize your transfer function, you have to make the shape catalog, your lens sample catalog, you have to measure the two-point data vector, characterize its redshift distribution, come up with a model, validate on n-body simulation, and then infer the cosmological parameters. So in previous 20-25 minutes, we have seen just this part, that we have come up with a model, we have validated them on n-body simulation, but that also at a 3D configuration space level. But all of this process is fairly complicated and is detailed in 30 different papers, which I have listed, shown here if people are interested in checking out any particular aspect of the analysis. But in here, we are interested in understanding galaxy biasing and pushing to smaller scales. So I think Subhadeep has a question.
Hey, Shivam, thanks. So I'd like to ask, like, for the simulations, you're choices of cosmological parameters, say like neutrino mass and other stuff, how much that will depend on your accuracy?
That is a good question. So we have only two different type of simulations. So we do validation in both of them, like both of them are n-body based simulation and use different fiducial cosmological parameter values. And our model works well on both of them, but we haven't validated them on a bunch of different hydrodynamical n-body simulation simulated at a lot of different cosmological space. So it might be that something breaks, but when we finally do the cosmological analysis, we are leaving the neutrino mass free. We are leaving. We also test the WCTR model, and we are leaving all of the omega matter, omega baryon with a very wide and uninformative prior. So I would think it should not change the conclusions as much, but yeah, we have not done a very, very direct validation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, so these are the final measurement for the galaxy clustering and galaxy lensing. So the galaxy clustering is detected at around 170 sigma and galaxy lensing at 120 sigma, so like around 200 sigma worth of total signal to noise. But with just a linear bias model that we cannot model to out to small scales, we only get to analyze around 80 sigma worth of signal to noise before we start to get biased cosmological constraints. But if we can push to smaller scales with this nonlinear bias model that we saw earlier, we can push to around 4 megaparsecs of our of the minimum scales that we analyze, and we get to analyze around 106 sigma worth of signal to noise. So we can right away see that we are gaining 25 sigma worth of signal to noise. But now let's see if it actually leads to better cosmological constraints. So this is now result on the data using the galaxy clustering and galaxy-galaxy lensing. So what you see are the two plots, the omega matter and S8. So S8 is a parameter constructed out of omega matter and sigma 8, as shown here. And each panel is showing you the red magic sample, the maglam sample in lambda CDM and WCDM space. And the black contours are the result from a linear bias analysis focused to larger scales, so 8 and 6 megaparsecs for galaxy clustering and galaxy-galaxy lensing. And the dashed line that you're seeing in blue is the nonlinear bias analysis pushing to smaller scales down to 4 megaparsecs as you validated earlier. And if you actually compare the figure of merit, we find that we gain around 20 to 40% in cosmological constraints depending upon the galaxy sample or the cosmological model. So I think Niyesh has a question.
Yes. So this is with the two-parameter bias model, is it right? When you say in a linear bias?
Yeah.
So have you tried it with the five-parameter bias model or three-parameter bias model?
So with five-parameter model, we tried with the four-parameter model. So we fixed the BK to zero and the BSN B3 NL varied, and that was very similar to the blue constraints that you see here. It was a little bit bigger than what you're seeing here, but not a lot.
I see. So you have tested that, and you say the answer doesn't change very much. But it's the same as the range of scales. You just add bias parameters.
Yeah.
And then it just gets bigger. Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll conclude the part one of the talk focusing on galaxy biasing. So we come up with a hybrid perturbation theory model. We developed a 5 or 6 parameter model, and we saw that a 2-parameter model is good enough to describe the accuracy that we care about with dark energy survey, and a 5-parameter model should definitely be good enough to describe the statistics at LSST level. And when we apply to the DS data, we find a 20 to 40% improvement in cosmological constraints. But I think to gain more from this model, we should think about how to model the higher order statistics also with this model that can probe to smaller scales, because that can lead to degeneracy breaking and lead to even tighter constraints.
But can I ask a question before you go on? I mean, if you can go back one slide, and we've heard this in other talks. I think Boov gave one, in fact. The maglim and the red magic are actually inconsistent with each other in this diagram. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. So if you look at the y-axis, the maglim is significantly higher compared to the red magic here. So we did find, after we unblinded our results using the red magic sample, we did find this particular probe with galaxy clustering and galaxy-galaxy lensing was preferring low S8 compared to, for example, the shear 2-point data vector. Yeah. But since then, we have narrowed it down to a heavy color selection. So some photometric issue in our data that leads to additional fluctuation in galaxy density if you select very heavily on color. And we don't know which particular observational systematics is causing this fluctuation. So we are not able to correct for it, but we know that it's related to the color selection. So it does not add on to the galaxy fluctuation, if you not select on color but on magnitude, for example, what maglim does, or if you measure the shape of the galaxy, which is what shear 2.0 does. So for example, like the
do you mean because it's like a selections in magnitude and in color in different bands, or some additional sensitivity to systematic errors or something like that?
I think so. It's like the observed density, also, so the observed galaxy field that we naturally get from telescope is of course very non-uniform and non-homogeneous, right? Because it's based on some observing conditions of, of like if in this particular patch, if you observed or not. So you correct for these using like, say what the air mass was, what the seeing map was, etc. throughout the course of your observation. So we try to correct that part, like based on those properties, both this maglim sample and the red magic sample. But it seems if you select on color, there is extra inhomogeneity in the density field that that does not correspond to any observed observing condition. So it's not possible to correct for it directly. So it's still an ongoing work. We are looking into it. But if you, for example, if you change the selection procedure of red magic and make it less stringent, like the way red magic works is it matches to, it tries to match each galaxy to a red galaxy template and tries, and if it matches well, it classifies it as red magic galaxy. So if you change the threshold of how stringent this matching has to be, it changes the results a lot. And it, if you make it less stringent, everything becomes consistent with either maglim results or with the shear 2.0 results. So that is saying that there is some problem in the color selection.
So do you worry in a more general sense that, you know, these types of errors or this type of selection could also propagate in general to like photosees, and then it messes up, could mess up the tomography aspect?
Yeah, so I think like there were various tests done on that it does not impact the tomography also. I think like because tomography is very heavily tied to the observations of deep fields as well, and I think like with deep fields we like any particular variation I don't think it can impact, but I'm not entirely sure. Just because we don't know the underlying basic cause of it, it's kind of hard to say. Okay. But like not selecting the main lens galaxy sample less stringently is the only thing that we have found that can move the results. Like any analysis choice that we change either in the photo-Z selection, like how the photo-Zs were inferred, or how the different maglim selection, et cetera, were done, or even if you widen the priors on the redshift or like the redshift estimate for any particular bin, it does not change things much. Like the redshift estimate has to be wrong by a lot for the red magic to become consistent with, for example, shear 2.0 or something.
Okay. Yeah, systematics errors dominated, I guess.
Yeah. So I think like this will definitely be an important thing going forward for DESI and LSST to check these things beforehand. Like these things should not come up after unblinding. So I think that's an ongoing piece of work for DSY6 also that people are very concerned about, and making sure that this does not happen again.
Thanks.
Just to make sure that I'm understanding like this discussion, so are you saying that once you account for color selection, your galaxy sample then is not necessarily well described by your simple two parameter bias model?
It's just that the measured galaxy so the measured galaxy clustering has an extra ingredient. So the or just to say the randoms are not accurately describing the the randoms that we need to construct the estimator are not completely correct. Like the galaxy has an additional fluctuation, which it's non-uniform beyond just what large scale structure would do and make it non-uniform.
So it could be an extra modulating systematic error or something like that.
Yeah.
And that increases the galaxy-galaxy correlation, but...
But does not change the galaxy matter, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I thought you were saying, though, you know, that these fluctuations in the density of the red magic galaxies do not correlate with things like, you know, air mass or right, like, so in that case then, like, well, what do they correlate with? I thought you were saying that they correlate with like actual density of matter, but they don't, you're saying.
It does not correlate with actual the underlying matter field distribution, but it does not also correlate with any observed systematics. So it's something other than normal observing conditions that is fluctuating the galaxy density if you select very heavily on color.
Okay, so therefore, if you tried to compute something like a cross correlation coefficient, you're saying that you're saying that you would find R much less than one on large scales.
Yep.
Is it the problem that these red galaxies are like the tail of the distribution, so they're kind of sensitive to small cuts, right? Well, you know, if a cut drifts a little bit because of some systematic error, it has a disproportionate effect on this special population.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Thanks a lot. Let me move on to the impact of baryonic feedback. I might skip some slides in here in interest of time. But in here, we are trying to look to constrain the baryonic feedback and its impact on matter distribution. And we will use the thermal Sonnev-Zeldovich effect and cross-correlate it with lensing in here. So to give a one slide introduction, the thermal Sonnev-Zeldovich effect happens when the cosmic microwave background gets inverse compton scattered by an energetic electron in the hot gas. And this changes the energy spectrum of the CMB in a very characteristic way. And you can do a multi-frequency observation of the CMB, and because it changes the energy spectrum in a very characteristic way, you can construct what's known as this Compton Y parameter map in the sky. And this Compton Y parameter is sensitive to the integrated pressure of hot gas along the line of sight. So it's a probe of the pressure. And because the pressure is happening because of hot gas, and hot gas is naturally correlated with the underlying matter field, this is a tracer of the underlying matter field. So you can choose, you can cross correlate this Compton Y map with the galaxy lensing that we saw, where the light from the background source is also weakly gravitationally lensed. So this particular cross correlation is then sensitive to the particularly sensitive to the underlying matter field, and it can also isolate the importance of the feedback, because as we saw, this Compton Y parameter is sensitive to the integrated pressure, like the total from our position to the redshift of cosmic microwave background. If you cross correlate, it's sensitive to the matter distribution in a characteristic way, but only until the redshift of this background source galaxy. Okay, so just to briefly show the measurements, so we use the data from both Atacama Cosmology Telescope and Planck. So this is the footprint, this whole tank-like footprint is where we observe the galaxy shear we make the shear map from dark energy survey. And in this particular nozzle of the tank region, we use the ACT data. And in rest of the survey, we use Planck data for the SC effect. And the lensing observable is split tomographically into four different tomographic bins, going from around redshift of 0 to around redshift of 1.5, with redshift distribution as shown here. So we cross correlate all of these the lensing map estimated from all of these four bins with the Compton Y map measured in this particular way. So these are the measurements. So what you are seeing is the correlation, the shear cross Y correlation as a function of angular scales for all the four different tomographic bins that I mentioned. And the two curves that you're seeing are the measurements for Planck in red, and the other one is for APT. So the total significance is around 20 sigma, and the error bars are estimated using analytical calculation in a halo model-based approach. And it includes the impact of non-Gaussian sources of covariance. Seeing this curve, it might seem like the Planck and ACT the measurements are highly discrepant, but they are not discrepant. It's just that the ACT has is a high resolution map and has different beam than what Planck does. So if you account for beam, they are consistent, and we account for the impact of the beam in our theory model when we fit these measurements. So, okay. Why is this measurement particularly interesting? Because it kind of probes the pressure and its impact on the underlying matter field very directly just by the nature of its construction. So in here, what you're seeing is its sensitivity to which halo masses and which halo redshift is this particular probe most sensitive to. So what you're seeing is this sensitivity to this shear crosswise signal to the redshift of the of different halos for the four different tomographic bins. And in the bottom panel, you're seeing sensitivity of, again, the signal as a function of halo masses. And in each panel, you see three different curves, which correspond to sensitivity of the signal at different angular scales that you're interested in. So if you just focus on the blue curves, which is like the 10 arc minute sensitivity, which where most of our signal to noise lies, we see that it's sensitive to halos of around 5 10 to power 13 to around 5 10 to power 14, and redshift of around 0.1 to around 0.3.4. So this very nicely bridges the gap in the sensitivity of galaxy cross Y and Compton Y cross Compton Y, which are sensitive to low and high mass respectively. And I think if we jointly model all three, galaxy cross Y, shear cross Y, and Compton Y cross Compton Y, that can give a very good validation across a large dynamic range of halo masses. Okay, so to finally analyze the measurement, we do a bunch of validation tests also for Compton Y. In particular, we test that the impact of cosmic infrared background is not leaking into Compton Y map. So the cosmic infrared background is just the dust in the circumgalactic and intergalactic medium, which can mimic the frequency dependence of what we expect from Compton Y. So it can leak into, if we don't have good enough multi-frequency observations of the CMB, it can leak into our Planck Y map or in Y map in general. And we do find, particularly for Planck, it is a significant contaminant, and we do correct for it in our analysis. Radio sources can also contaminate the Compton Y map, but we test for it using a very faint radio source mask from ACT, and we find that it does not lead to significant contamination in our correlation functions. On cosmic shear side, the map that's used is the same one that was used for cosmology results, so it has gone through extensive testing as detailed in this paper. One particular impact that we first found and forward modeled in this particular type of analysis was the intrinsic alignment. So remember the cosmic shear or this lensing is looking for distortion in the shape, but if the source galaxy itself at the source plane are aligned due to large scale fields, that can you have to take that into account when you model the correlation. So this is known as intrinsic alignment, and that can contribute to this cross correlation with Compton Y, and we forward model it and include in our theory predictions. Okay, so we saw that our shear cross Y signal is can be modeled as a contribution from the cosmological correlation, but then we also have the a contribution from the intrinsic alignment cross Compton Y. And this particular correlation is sensitive to cosmology as well as pressure profile of the hard gas. And because we have a single probe, we cannot jointly constrain both cosmology and pressure profile. So we split our analysis in two different parts. In the first one, we vary the cosmology, but we keep the pressure profile fixed. And in the second one, we keep the cosmology fixed and we vary the pressure profile. So in the first part, when varying the cosmology within Planck or DES priors, we fix the pressure profile to the prediction from different hydrodynamical simulations. So you can look at this analysis as trying to see if hydrodynamical simulations that people run are the pressure profile that they get are preferred by our data or not, assuming that cosmology is what Planck or DES gives. And the second part, you can look at if we completely trust the cosmology. We are constraining what the actual pressure profile is, and then we can get some quantitative results on that. Okay, so first we go with the case of fixing the pressure profile to different hydrodynamical simulation cases and predicting the cosmology. So in this particular plot, what's shown here is the prior for the Planck, so which is, as you can see, very tight. And the result on the cosmological constraint, the sigma eta and omega matter that you get for different hydrodynamical simulations. So the hydrodynamical simulations that we use are from either these OWL simulation, the overwhelmingly large suite of simulation using the reference or AGN model, or the illustrious TNG simulation. And in here, we also model how the shear or the dark matter profile will change if there is any impact of feedback. So in this particular aggressive case that we analyze here, we are rescaling the dark matter profile when there is any impact of feedback by directly using the power spectra from the simulation. So we are not modeling how any feedback process impacts the dark matter profile in a very mass dependent way. So we are changing the dark matter profile directly with this ratio of the measured matter power spectra with dark matter barons or versus just dark matter. And the takeaway from this particular slide is that if you try to quantify which hydrodynamical simulation is preferred as a tension between what the prior is and what the cosmological constraints you get when you analyze with pressure profile of different hydrodynamical simulation, you find this AGN 8.5 simulation is more preferred. That is saying that our data, given Planck cosmology, prefers a larger feedback corresponding to AGN 8.5. But again, the caveat is that this assumes a very particular way the dark matter profile can change based on any feedback physics. We also try a very conservative approach where instead of fixing how the dark matter profile can change, we parameterize its change. So we assume additional.
Can I ask a question? Do you mind going back? I just want to understand what this is saying, because I mean, these simulations, you do have dark matter and baryons in them. So, I mean, why do you have to make any assumption? You could just, measure the, you could just measure the correlation function of the simulation. Now, they are being done with a specific parameter, so you have to change them with different parameters. I don't know actually how you do that when you change the parameters, because the simulation is done for a particular set of parameters.
So we are keeping the pressure profile fixed. That's what, so the pressure profile, or like the pressure profile we are assuming, is independent of the cosmology, which is not a bad approximation, because I think the pressure profile itself is kind of determined by the very local potential. And I think like that particular potential is like a very locally dominated thing. So if you change, say, sigma 8, that should not change how the pressure profile looks like in a particular halo, for example. So it should only change at the two halo clustering level.
Well, I mean, ideally, I would want to see that verified, because I mean, baryons are complicated and everything depends on everything. But okay, so I guess that would be then the thing that in principle, you want to have like these simulations with multiple parameters and then use actual simulations, and then you have everything you need at that point.
You say
you don't do that right now.
Yeah, we don't have access to simulations run at different parameters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, so with this particular analysis, when we try to be conservative, I'll just summarize that our takeaway is that because of these additional two parameters, we lose the ability to demarcate between different hydrodynamical simulations. Our tension between the prior and what the cosmological or what the cosmological constraints we get assuming pressure profile from different simulations is fairly consistent with one. But I think like if we jointly model this with shear 2-point or KSZ information, we'll be able to break the degeneracies and get tight constraints in here also. Okay, so we now jump to the second case where we fix the cosmology to either DS or Planck, and we vary the pressure profile parameters themselves. So the parameters that we vary are four different parameters. So the parameter controlling the amplitude of the pressure profile, its slope at larger radii, its evolution with redshift, and its evolution with mass. So what you're seeing are the constraint on these parameters. And if you just focus on the black contours, it's corresponding to the final ACT plus Planck data. And the dashed line, the dashed gray lines that you're seeing are the preferred values, assuming these Battaglia et al. 2012 simulations. So what you find is while for P naught and beta, it's very consistent, for alpha Z and alpha M, the evolution with redshift and mass, there is slight preference for lower alpha Z and higher alpha M. So if we take those constraints and forward them to some physical observables. So in this particular plot, what we have done is taken the constraint on the pressure profiles from previous plot and tried to compute the thermal energy of the halos. And if we just focus on the plot on the left, that's plotting the thermal energy within R200C relative to the prediction from the simulation as a function of halo mass. And the three different color bands that you see are at different redshifts. So what you see is that while at higher masses, it's consistent with what the simulations predict. At lower masses, we have preference for lower thermal energy, which is consistent with feedback pushing the gas out. And this is also consistent with what we saw in the previous case where we fixed the pressure profile and change the cosmology, that we prefer the higher feedback that can push the gas out of the halos. We also predict this YM relationship, which is the integrated Compton Y within some Y500C. And again, we find that at lower halo masses, the prediction, which is in blue band, is lower compared to what different simulations predict, which is in different lines. And kind of consistent with what these AGN simulation predicts. I think Niyesh has a question.
Actually, I think Suvedip was before me.
Oh, sorry. Suvedip. Yeah.
Go ahead, Suvedip.
Yeah, thanks. So I have a question, I think two slides back when you're showing the plots on the conclusion that the AGN feedback for a particular model is more consistent. So what choice of scales you go in the for when you choose the clusters, after what theta or R value you consider?
This is using all scales. So our model is now halo model based model. So we have one halo and two halo term. And we have checked different scales also how we combine the one halo and two halo, like to take care of the transition regimes issue, et cetera. And our conclusions are pretty robust to that we always prefer the, like this thing is kind of driven by all scales. It's not just in small scales or just in large scale that drives the preference for larger feedback. So like all scales are consistent, okay, at least within the model. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so so this is kind of very interesting. You get various small y's at the small masses. Have you tried negative y's, or you just put a prior that it should be positive?
So I think like for negative y, we use the constraints on these particular parameter to infer y. And I think like the negative or positivity would be controlled by this P naught parameter. And we do have a hard prior that it is positive.
But
you can see like it does not, I mean, like if you look at the black line, it kind of prefers remaining positive also. But yeah, we haven't checked if we let it go negative, how the results will change.
Well, I mean, clearly for large masses, it is positive because you do see SC effect. But then for a small masses, it looks like, I mean, you get very small values, much smaller than simulations. And I'm just wondering whether it's even prefers it to, I mean, can you tell it should be positive? My suspicion is that you cannot tell that it must be positive. I mean, basically it's all prior at the small masses, right?
I mean, yeah, because maybe at down to very small masses where our sensitivity goes very low. So for 10 to the power 13, for example, this you can consider it's a little bit of an extrapolation, I think. But we are fairly sensitive to halos, like, for example, around 5, 10 to the power 13 or something. So I would not think this particular thing is prior dominated as such. Like this thing seems like, but
is this you the may 68, be right. yeah. 68% region you're plotting?
It's the 68% region, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of a curious thing that they notice. And in fact, I mean, other papers have seen something like that too, that if you go to very small masses, then it seems that Y can become negative, which, I mean, it doesn't mean we have negative energy, but it means there's something funny going on, which could be just a very, very strong feedback, much more than any of these simulations can do. But right now you have the prior that it doesn't go negative. Yeah. So, okay, cool.
Okay, but yeah, that's an interesting test. Yeah,
I think it's an interesting thing. Good.
Thanks. Yeah. So, okay, in 1 minute, I can summarize the other model also. So we now switch the model. So again, our cosmology is fixed to either DS or Planck, but we are analyzing with a different model, which is this NOT 2010 pressure profile model. And in here, we have only one free parameter. So we all the aspects of the pressure profile are fixed, but we only change this mass bias parameter, which kind of encapsulates how the halo mass that you can infer assuming a hydrostatic equilibrium differs from the true mass of the halo. So it is like the SC mass assuming hydrostatic equilibrium relates to true mass divided by this parameter B. And we do expect the hydrostatic equilibrium to be violated at some level. And we, based on non-thermal pressure support, we expect this parameter B to be around 1.1 or 1.2. But in here, you see our results. So if we focus just on the Planck cosmology, we find that the inferred B is very high. It's around 1.7 and very much further away from the preferred value of 1.1 or 1.2. But interestingly, this is very similar to what the inferred constraint are from various other studies, like either analyzing the cluster count cosmology or analyzing the Compton Y auto power. But what you find is if you lower the preferred cosmology to DS, as in like if you lower the preferred sigma 8 value, it changes the inferred parameter B and lowers it and makes it a little consistent with the theoretical value. Or you can also put in some redshift evolution of this particular mass bias. And if you assume a redshift evolution, assuming some power law, and then try to infer what this parameter B should be at redshift of zero, although it's due to degeneracy, you lose the ability to demarcate, but it goes in the right direction. So you can draw the conclusion that at least even from the study, although we need more degeneracy breaking to say it conclusively, lowering the cosmology or some kind of redshift evolution can reconcile this long-standing puzzle that from cluster cosmology or Compton Y auto analysis, the inferred mass bias constraints are in tension with what we expect theoretically or from other studies looking at other probes. Okay, so I'll leave the conclusion slide in here and probably take questions. Sorry if I ran a little late.
Oh, no, this is not late, actually. this is right on time. But okay, great, yeah. Right, so then why don't we all unmute to give Shivam a round of applause for his great talk.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so we do have time for further questions if there are any. So please just go ahead and jump in if you have a question. Well, so maybe I can maybe kick it off. I mean, right, like so you had this interesting result with like, you know, very low Ys at low mass, which you said favors a large hydrostatic mass bias. Can you remind me, like, you know, so my impression was that towards lower halo masses, we expect more of these like turbulent motions and therefore like a larger bias. Is that correct?
I mean, you're right that No, I think you're right that at lower halo masses, there should be more environmental impact, and it could be that the non-thermal pressure support can change, and just assuming this kind of a single parameter describing things across the halo masses is not particularly correct. So that's the thing. Like it could be that this particular model has to be physically significantly much more complicated. It has to depend on the halo masses. It has to depend on the redshift. It has to depend probably on the environment also, and probably if you had that would probably reconcile this result of high mass bias versus the preferred value of low mass bias. But I think like there are some paper by Ashiro Komatsu's group where they find that this particular value is approximately 1.2 at a wide range of halo masses, at least using some theoretical and numerical calculations.
Okay, I see. All right, thanks. Jesse, yeah, please go ahead.
Hey, apologies if you mentioned this and I missed it, but I don't actually know if this is related, but I know in the like cluster cosmology group in DES, there's a lot of discussion about sort of things like line of sight protection or like the potential that like the cluster might not be spherical and you might potentially be selecting for things that are a little bit like oblong along the line of sight. Does that come in at all? Or is that anything you need to worry about with these kind of SD analyses? Or is that more relevant just when you're dealing with like richness?
I think it's more related to the optical clusters. I think like with SZ, the signal scales as m to the power 5/3 or something. So it's not as susceptible to the issues of some other clusters sitting in the line of sight, et cetera. So I think like it has been shown that the SZ cluster count analysis, which is, for example, what Planck did, is less prone to systematic biases, for example, what happens with RedMapper.
So can I think I kind of got lost in this last slide. So what is the lesson here, that this is a green is much lower than all the other ones? Can you just repeat that?
So I think the takeaway was like, if you analyze a single mass bias parameter at Planck cosmology, the results are consistent with previous mm-hmm. studies of cluster count or Compton Y. But if you lower the preferred sigma 8 value to weak lensing type analysis compared to, for example, mm-hmm. what DS5 does, it lowers this mass bias to closer to the theoretically expected value of around 1.2. But you can also assume some kind of redshift evolution. And if you do it, it leads to degeneracy and it's like you don't have a tight constraint, but it goes towards the correct mm-hmm. direction of lowering it. So if you can combine with some external probe, for example, if you combine with some KSZ information or with with KSZ information, that should be able to break the degeneracy and see if this particular kind of redshift evolution can resolve the tension.
So this value of 1.8 is kind of crazy. I mean, do we expect that? Okay, so but they say if you just take Planck analysis itself seriously, then you really need this 1.8 value to make it consistent. Okay, that's weird. So is that kind of an internal inconsistent? Well, so you say, is this Planck SD analysis and Planck cosmological parameters combined, they require a bias of 1.8?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what you're saying. Exactly. That's just kind of crazy. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Stuart, go ahead.
Yeah, so let me start a little question, maybe crazy one. Have you thought about whether this parameter B can be related on the mass of the true mass of the cluster itself? Can there be a dependence on that?
There can be. Unfortunately, we did not run that particular chain, but yeah, it has been in our like discussion. So I think we are updating this analysis because we now have we'll very soon have the YMAP with just the ACT experiment covering the full DS area. So that should we should be able to push to significantly smaller scales. And I think in that analysis we'll do a more thorough job of seeing which other models we can analyze with them.
Because we can have a selection effect of seeing particularly the heavier one and seeing possibly a bias to because of that reason as too.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm not seeing any further questions. So let's stop here then. So thanks again, Shivam. And thanks everyone else also for coming to this special Friday seminar. And so we'll see you all next time. Okay, so
thanks a lot for inviting. Yeah, it was great to interact.
Thank you.
Yeah.